Postscript Media, podcast for a changing planet.
I probably like our callers. You know, you look around, you're like, well, I need to buy something nice, but what? Because I'm really uncomfortable buying fancy clothes or anything. And I tried one of my dad's hand-me-down Zena suits, and I looked a little like an Italian mobster. So I passed on that look for conferences. And
I feel like every man's tried the Zena and been like,
yeah.
Nope.
Nope. Yeah. I'm only in my 30s, you know, come on.
Maybe if I were 30 years old.
Yeah.
This is Hot Buttons, a show about the future of fashion and culture on a changing planet. I'm Christina Binkley. I'm a contributing writer at Vogue Business and The Wall Street Journal. Well, this week, we're turning to our call-in line. And you know what? We listened to the first voicemails. We were a little surprised to hear that they were all from men. Well, duh. Anyone who's been paying attention knows that men are the fastest growing segment of fashion spending, but we have obviously been neglecting them on Hot Buttons. So here goes. We're going to try and answer their questions in this episode and talk more broadly about men's fashions and if the approach to sustainability is any different than women's. And as always, we'll look at the week's headlines to see if the fashion industry is making progress towards sustainable futures or not.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Rachel Kibbe of Circular Services Group is in New York. Rachel, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you, Christina?
I'm doing good. Thank you. And the CEO of Thrilling, Shilla Kim Parker, is coming to us as always from South Salem, New York. Hey, Shilla.
Hi, Christina.
To get rolling, I was going to ask you guys to tell me something fabulous that you ate this week, but then we all woke up. Something fun and non-fashion related, but then we woke up and this Yay Yeezy YZE thing happened in Paris, and some of us were so triggered that I figure we might as well just leap right in. Kanye West, yet now known as Ye, had a surprise fashion show in Paris yesterday, and while the clothes were sort of interesting, no one is talking about them because of what Ye wore and what it means. Rachel, do you have thoughts to share on Ye's White Lives Matter tee? Shilla, you too.
Well, first of all, I was saying before the episode, I think we should give him as little airtime as possible because this is part of the problem. And that's why we're not going to devote a whole lot of time on this episode to speaking about it because he doesn't deserve it. All I want to say is the fashion industry is at fault for continuing to line his pockets. These companies, including Demna from Balenciaga, have such little foresight that they continue to hire him and leverage his audience when he is clearly a sick, sick person. And not only sick, he is aligned with Trump. They are very good bedfellows. And he seemingly shows signs of being abusive and narcissistic, along with being untreated for his mental health problems. He is racist. He is violent. And he incites and inspires a lot of bad behavior among people that are fragile. We have a very fragile country right now. And I don't think it's funny. I don't think he should be allowed to be given a platform any longer by the fashion industry. Gap should not have hired him. Balenciaga should not have allowed him to open a show. He has proven time and again to be not a great human. I watched the Kardashians. It was abusive towards Kim on camera on multiple occasions, which no one talked about. And it makes me really upset that we continue to allow him to have a platform. And that's all I'm going to say, because I'm really upset. I'm really upset.
It's worth noting, by the way, that he's also been on Instagram all morning ranting, and he went after, with two Instagram posts, a young, absolutely delightful stylist, Black stylist, who's been working with Vogue. She's really making a career for herself, and she's like, honestly, she's like a ray of sunshine every time she goes into a room. I mean, she's just, I don't know why he decided to go after her. I'm not going to name her because I don't want more people going and looking after her. I hope she has a quiet day, but I doubt she is having a quiet day after something like that. So it's gross.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you guys more. And I was encouraged by the fact, you know, his past antics. A lot of times folks in the Black community would defend him. You know, slavery is a choice and the Trump antics and the MAGA hats. And there were strong segments in the Black community that would come to his defense. And now it feels like the tide is really turning. And I think it's also worth really engaging with why what he wore is so problematic, because I also see some strands of what's the big deal with that phrase, White Lives Matter. And why the big reaction. And there's this Black producer, Van Lathan, who, and I'm going to read what he wrote because I think it's worth reading, and I think he says it quite eloquently. But he writes, "We don't need a reminder of the worth of white lives. America is a shrine to the worth of white people. This message is reactionary to a message affirming the worth of Black lives, which have never been worth anything in America. In its intent, it's a white supremacist notion because it posits that we can't have a conversation about the worth of Black people without having a conversation about the worth of white people, which is insane. The notion that it always has to be about white people in America is incredibly frustrating, emotionally draining, and the whole problem. But here's Kanye apparently centering that notion." And that's, I think, all that needs to be said.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chilla.
Okay, let's look at the headlines. This week, we saw Levi's release their net zero goal by 2050 pledge, which they apparently thought was worth applause. I'm sorry, a promise to get to net zero by the time my unborn grandchildren are adults is unworthy of applause. Snap, snap, folks. Let's see some action here. And then, sort of in the same light, Sourcing Journal reported on Shein's commitment to the Apparel Impact Institute. Rachel, you took a dive into that. Tell us.
Well, I've been talking about Apparel Impact Institute's fund for several episodes, and I think what they're doing is a worthy cause. I don't think $7.6 billion from a company that's valued at $100 billion is meaningful. I'm glad Apparel Impact Institute is collecting more funds for their worthy work, but I also think it on Shein's behalf, it's not enough. And other companies who are worth far less have put in more. I suspect they have put in more. I think there are some other companies that have put in around 10 a piece, at least.
10 million,
yeah,
you mean?
10 million. Sorry, did I say billion? 10 million. Yeah. So
and Shein put in
7.6. Yeah.
Million.
That's
million.
Been reported, okay. Which was a strange number and just didn't seem, you know, it just, whatever.
I think you
well said. Whatever.
Whatever.
Sorry. I mean, like, stop producing so many clothes. Just stop producing. How about also stop producing so many clothes?
The only thing that I thought was interesting, Rachel, in that story was that it said Shein's carbon emissions in 2021 is at 6 million tons and H&M Group's at 7.8 million metric tons and Zara is at 17 million metric tons over the same period. And so I was wondering whether that seemed right to you, because we focus a lot of our energy on Shein based on their production volumes. And here in the article, it kind of laid out the carbon emissions is actually of the three big fast fashion groups is on the lower end. Does that seem right?
I have no idea. I have no idea how they're measuring. Like, are they measuring their full scope three? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even leave it to people like me to measure the accuracy of what any of these companies are reporting.
I can't imagine
right.
that we can believe those numbers.
Right.
It just doesn't seem, it seems all made up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if someone is listening to this and has a little bit more insight than I do into that, I would love a call-in about it, actually.
Is there a major in carbon accounting anywhere at some finance school? Wharton should have a major in carbon accounting,
I'm sure there's,
I think.
It's a great
idea.
I'm sure there's some, at this point, ways to do it.
I hope so.
Although all of these, like any type of accounting or any type of, you know, it's numbers can be used.
But generally accepted accounting principles are pretty good.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. We just need that for carbon.
Right.
And not just currencies. Okay, we have another big headline that has a lot of people jammering today and yesterday. Just this morning, we saw that the South Korean internet company Naver announced that it's acquiring Poshmark in a deal valued at $1.2 billion. This is the largest acquisition yet by Naver, who they call the Google of South Korea. It's a big internet company. It's a search engine, and it also has e-tailing operations. This gets Naver further into the North American market and into resale. It's a perfect cap to secondhand September, I guess, but it sent Naver's shares tumbling. So apparently investors don't like the deal. That didn't surprise Shilla one bit. I think you read the writing on the wall.
Well, I was shocked by this news, actually. Completely shocked. I was surprised that Poshmark was in the market to be sold. They are, I think, the biggest apparel marketplace, apparel-only marketplace in the game. They've got 80 million users across US, Canada, Australia, and I think India. There's one other country, but mostly US and Canada. They only IPO'd just the beginning of last year. They came out, they set their price at $42 a share, which gave them about a $3 billion valuation. Like everybody, they're down a lot this year. They're down about 80%. And this valuation, I mean, this acquisition valued them at $1.2 billion. So I was surprised that, you know, if you listen to their last earnings calls, the CEO was really focused on getting to profitability, one, and two, expanding categories. But they were very well positioned because they're such a juggernaut. The idea that they felt like this was the best pathway for their future, rather than fighting for shareholder value and focusing on organic growth, was really surprising to me. But obviously, they did what they felt like was best for them. The other thing that I thought was really surprising is that in this environment, so it's an all-cash offer for a not profitable company, which maybe I think in this particular environment was a little bit surprising, since most folks are focused on profitability and returning cash. And so I was a little bit surprised by that as well. And then the reasons for the marriage.
Why is it important that it was an all-cash offer as opposed to like cash and stock in Naver or something?
Yeah, that cash is gone. So I'm surprised that given that they're not profitable, resale marketplaces have had a very challenging year. The path ahead still seems challenging given the macroeconomic headwinds. As much as I believe in Poshmark, there's still some risk in the deal. And so I'm surprised that they didn't, you know, mitigate some of that risk by leveraging stock for part of the purchase price.
So congratulations to Poshmark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, congratulations to Poshmark. And then my last point on it is just, I think it's an odd marriage. Now, I am half Korean, so I'm bullish on anything Korean. It's a company that's based in South Korea. It's really focused on the South Korean market. That's where its assets are. Some of the reasons they came out of the gate with where they saw the synergies, they talked about content and that it has a large number of bloggers in Korea. They talked about Naver owning the second largest metaverse app. They talked about owning digital comics and empowering content creation. And all those things don't seem like organic fits with what Poshmark strengths are in the US.
Like the most basic resale shopper, American basic resale shopper. Yeah. Like it's like where I go to find, you know, if I really want to find a great pair of American jeans.
Could it have anything to do with their platform? Like, is there something special? I mean, I'm not suggesting there is because I don't know of it. That's the only thing I could think of is maybe there was something about the technology that Poshmark has developed.
I'm sure.
They talk about wanting to enter the U.S. market. This is a great way for them to enter the U.S. market. Now, I think that they can absolutely make it work. There's certainly some really interesting strategic directions they could go. But I think it'll probably be a lot of work to bring those synergies to life. Anyway, very surprising, really interesting to see where it goes. And certainly, I think, indicative of the growing consolidation we're going to see in the space. I do think we're going to see more mergers across resale companies and startups in the space.
Care to take any guesses? Like who might be in play?
The fact that I never in a million years would have thought Poshmark was in play, that means everyone is in play.
Okay. Wow.
That's my takeaway. I mean, given the context of the state of the overall resale market, they would have been the last player I would have thought to sell. And so I don't know if they have cold feet or as like the smartest or just luckiest, because obviously this they had been probably planning on this for a really long time. It's a really tough market, especially for the resale companies that have IPO'd. Wall Street is not valuing them. I think it's unjustified, but it's really impacting their ability to operate. And there have been a lot of layoffs. Maybe they just saw the writing on the wall and thought that the next, 2 to 5 years would be too challenging. And their stock price relative to some of the other resale platforms was actually up quite a bit higher. And so maybe they just wanted to get out while the going was relatively good and then cut their losses. And this seems like the best sort of deal that they could get in the context of the overall environment. I don't know that an American company would have bought them for a similar price. We did see Depop get sold for almost exactly the same amount about a year ago, maybe more like closer to 2 years ago, but in 2021, but at nearly 23 times their revenue multiple, whereas Poshmark sold at only 5 times their revenue multiple. And Depop has close to half the number of buyers that Poshmark has. And a 15% lower average order value. So the environment.
Timing is everything.
Yeah. So timing is everything.
Yes.
And they might have, it's kind of been a dark night for resale platforms in terms of their ability to grow and operate in the context of sort of publicly traded companies. I don't know a whole lot about like the shopper in South Korea. So Depop sold to Etsy, and my understanding is that it operates as its own company, although Etsy owns them. And so I wonder if Poshmark will be sort of, knowing that there's such cultural differences, and obviously American shoppers are going to be different than South Korean shoppers, I wonder how much they'll let them continue their sort of planned growth trajectory.
Well, they're keeping the CEO. That says a lot. He's sticking around, so... And he's the founder.
I thought it was really interesting that the CEO of Naver is a 40-year-old woman who went to Harvard undergrad and later law school. And so she is a young woman who understands the resale, the opportunity of the resale market. So yeah. I thought that was interesting.
You always got to bet on Koreans.
Okay. Well,
their interest in fashion is huge.
Yeah.
I mean, really, they have proven time and time again to be just absolutely avid consumers of fashion at all levels. We should also acknowledge that the real winners in this whole deal are the VCs that backed Poshmark in the first place and got out at the $3 billion valuation instead of the $1.2 billion.
Right.
Congratulations to them.
Take us out to dinner, guys.
A lot of winners based on that metric last year.
Yeah, exactly. So we are now going to move on to our main theme here. The topic of our week is men, and in particular, the men's fashion and sustainability. People have been emailing, tweeting, and DMing us with their fashion questions and comments, but fewer have left voicemails. And you know what? The first ones to leave a message were men, really earnest men, looking for help navigating the confusing world of clothing retail when looking to shop sustainably. So we're going to take this on today and see how we can help. First, let's have a quick listen to one of our messages, which gets right to the point.
Hi, my name is David in Indiana. I've been a big fan of the show since it started. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the sustainability challenges are that are different in the context of menswear versus women's fashion. It seems like your show's mostly covered women's fashion so far, and I'd love to hear a comparison. Thanks. Keep up the great work.
When we're talking about sustainability for men's apparel, we need to recognize that the men's market has been trending toward women's shopping habits since about 2009. More men are shopping based on style trends, and the sales growth of menswear has outpaced women's for the past decade. So the same tenets apply to all apparel. buy less, buy better, repair more if you want to think more sustainably. I find it personally, watching this play out over time, it's occurred to me that men at one time actually were more sustainable fashion consumers than women were. I don't think that's the case anymore, but that's certainly what was traditional, and having suits in their closet that they cared for and dry cleaned and repaired. Shilla, speaking of resale sites, where can men, let's just throw out some options here. Where can men look for great selections of previously owned garments?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the platforms that we've mentioned in the past also sell men's. So Poshmark, The RealReal, Etsy, eBay, every major platform is going to have a sizable men's collection, Thrilling as well. And then there are folks that have been historically more centered on men's. So Grailed is focused exclusively on men's, and then StockX and GOAT, which is now unisex, but kind of historically had more of a male-centered audience focused. They started with sneakers and they've kind of expanded their categories. But so there's a ton of options. Now, I will say in general, women's clothing does tend to dominate resale markets. And I do think it does have to do with the fact, something that you mentioned, Christina, that we tend to shop and wear clothes differently than men. More frequent cycles of clothing. We buy more frequently. We get rid of more clothes more frequently. And therefore, you're going to see more women's clothing in general on resale markets than men. But if you never bought a single new thing ever again and relied solely on resale marketplaces, you would have a fully stocked closet and look amazing. There's no shortage of options.
That's great. Rachel, I feel like we talk about women's wear to the exclusion of men's wear even when it comes to circularity. And I'm wondering if you see differences in the circularity of men's and women's fashions, or is it really just one industry?
Well, I think, you know, as our listeners probably understand now, circularity is complicated and it's not just one thing. So the logistics of circularity at the end of the value chain for recycling obviously would be, or life extension of clothing, the logistics or how you get things to the next place, exactly the same. But to Shilla's point, the marketing side or the resale side, both from actually new clothing, more sustainable clothing, or used clothing, is quite different for men, between men and women. So if we're talking about circularity in terms of life extension of clothes or reuse, men wear the hell out of their clothing. Not only do they buy less and turn over their wardrobes less, when it does ultimately get to a thrift store, it's often more worn out and less fit for resale, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just less exciting sometimes, I think, for men to shop used. And some of the big resale platforms, I don't think ThredUp has men's at all. And from a marketing perspective, it's very different to market to men and women. They're two different customers. The sizing's different. It's challenging. So smaller stores, especially online-based, that have to deal with single-unit SKUs often will choose one or the other to start because it's just challenging. There's a challenge marketing to both men and women at the same time. So I actually reached out to some of my male friends to ask them, because I don't consider myself a men's fashion expert at all. So anything I'm telling you right now is things that I've done research on or asked some of my friends. So my friend Adam, I texted him this morning because he is so good. He will take me vintage shopping and like pick out the best dress for me. Yeah, oh. He's got such a great eye.
Can I be friends with Adam?
You can absolutely be friends with Adam. Adam is the best and would be friends with anybody. So he said there's really not that many good fashions places. They're just cowboy shirts and plaid tech guy shirts. They haven't updated men's buying since 2002. And this is kind of the overall sentiment I've gotten from men. Men are like frustrated.
Was he talking about at resale stores or just in general at all?
Both.
Men's fashion.
Both. So what you're finding in new, well, he's not hype beast. He's not going to, and I've seen that. Like, he doesn't want Balenciaga, but he doesn't want a tech bro, a Faherty, and I love Faherty. You know, he has, I don't think men are being given a whole lot of in between. So for the men who are confused about how to shop more sustainably, if you want to buy something new, if you're not ready to buy used or you want to mix it up, I would say what I say to women. It's very hard to know how sustainable something is until greenwashing is regulated. So go for durability, go for quality, put some money into it. If you see it reselling for a good value on resale sites, maybe, and you don't want to buy it used, buy it new and resell it later, because that means that it holds value and most likely it is durable.
You know what? I would add in here that I think that somehow in the transfer of generations, it used to be in the olden days that the older generation taught the younger generation, their sons and daughters, how to buy clothes, what to look for. And I didn't get that in my family. And I think a lot of people don't get it now. But, you know, but I've learned over covering fashion that, for instance, when you go into a store and you're looking at an item, you feel the hand of the fabric. Grab that and squeeze it and see if it wrinkles. Because if it wrinkles immediately, it's going to look crap when you wear it, right? It's probably cheap fabric, particularly when it comes with wool.
I love that. Right?
So that, then turn it inside out and look, are the seams finished? Are they taped? Are they going to unravel when the garment is washed or cleaned? Is there a wide seam allowance so that it can be altered for you? A lot of times, one of the ways fashion brands save money, especially fast fashion, is they have the tiniest seams, like 4 threads, you know? And you could never let the garment out. You could take it in, but you can't let it out.
Christina, it's so interesting you bring that up because another guy I polled, who is Seth Levy, who's the outgoing head of sustainability and policy at ThredUp, he's an advisor of mine. He he called out Savile Row. Am I saying it right?
Yeah.
I've always read
Savile.
Okay, Savile Row, which is a street in London that's known for bespoke men's tailoring. So he said, you know, so Prince Philip was known for having suits tailored for 50 years. And he sent me this link to this website, Anderson and Shepherd, that says on the website that the clothes are meant to be passed down for generations. Our clothing is built to last and contains generous amounts of inlay, allowing for it to be altered over the years as your shape changes or as it's passed down between generations. That's what it says on the website. And it's like, we don't think about our clothes like that anymore. And that's going to be an investment, but you could have it for generations, literally.
And your shape is going to change over the span of your life. So you have to be able to alter your clothes, which requires, by the way, quality fabric. You know, one thing to look for, this is something that is still in a lot of men's pants and menswear, but I've noticed lately, particularly in fast fashion, they're skipping that. If you look at the back of the waistband on men's pants, rarely can you get this in women's pants, and I wish you could. It's split so that it's sewn together in the back, and that's so you can take it in and out very easily with a few snips and sewing instead of having to remove and rebuild the entire waistband, which is what you often have to do with women's wear. So, I mean, that immediately increases the value of a pair of pants in their lifetime value, right? If you look at cost per wear, I don't know about you guys, if you look in your closet, and I know this is the case for everybody, that sometimes the most we spent on a garment is actually the least expensive garment because we've worn it so many times, right?
Right.
And you only maybe get rid of it when you potentially resell it or give it to somebody else because you feel like a connection to it and its quality and durability. It's not something that you're going to throw in a trash bag and put in a bin. I know a lot of men shop like this. Not all, but a lot. Just tell me what to buy. Like, just tell me what to buy. So I made a list of a few brands if they don't want to buy used. Would
great.
That be helpful?
Nice. I mean,
they're just brands I trust and I think are going in the right direction. They're not perfect. Okay, I'll go through it. Okay, shoes. Veya, On Running, Nisolo, and then Bombas, the socks. I like that company a lot. And Allen Edmonds, because they have repairs. Casual hangout workout gear, Vuori, I'm probably saying it wrong, but they're climate neutral. Pangaea, because they're investing in material science. And Marine Layer, because they are investing in recycling. Outerwear, Barber, classic. You can never go wrong with Barber. Patagonia, built for a lifetime. Arc'teryx, incredible repair programs. Timberland, forefront of circularity and sustainability for a big, big brand. Carhartt and Pendleton, classics. Work more formal. Burberry, they've got a net zero, unlike Levi's, they've got a net zero commitment by 2040, not 2050. Faherty, they're smaller, but they really mean it. They make really sort of classic built-to-last clothes. Billy Reid, I think they're made in the United States. Paul Smith, every man I know who likes fashion has some Paul Smith. Brooks Brothers, if it's made in the USA, I've heard they're better made if you find they're made in the USA labels, and Brooks Brothers from the 80s in particular. And then someone suggested Drakes of London for ties.
You know, there's a few smaller companies that came across my radar. One was is a Swedish men's basics brand called Ascot. I thought they were interesting because they're working towards 100% traceability from farm to finished garment. And they're including a receipt in each garment you buy about their impact, where it came from, water consumption, energy. So they're trying their best to be 100% transparent through their entire production and supply chain. There's an LA brand called Older Brother. They started using ingredients like mushrooms and sea kelp. That's the only way they dye their clothes. They source all of their materials from Japan, and they're all made in LA. And then the last brand that came across my radar is called JCRT. They partner with a company called Resonance Factory, which handles all production in the Dominican Republic. Anyway, those were three kind of smaller brands that came across my radar for men.
You know, there's an online platform called Garmentory that doesn't get enough shine, but they do a really good job. I'm sure, Shil, you know of them. But I came across them again, and every time I visit their website, they're doing better. Now they have not only new clothing, but resale and vintage, clearly, for men and women, and some really great brands. Really well-made brands.
So, guys, we have spent most of our lives listening to men opine on women's issues, and here we are doing the same thing in reverse. It turns out that we have an actual man on our podcast team who is living these actual issues in real time. Scott Clavetta, come on down. Hi, Scott.
Hey, you guys. This is fun. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for coming.
Yes. Quick background here. We were talking, we have all along this path of hot buttons sort of watched Scott's interest in fashion blossoming. It turns out that's not actually completely new. It's been going on sort of evolving over many years. And Scott filled us in on that in Slack this week. It was fascinating. I feel like your fashion journey, Scott, is very relevant to the industry today. So could you just walk us briefly through how you evolved from a punk enthusiast to a fascination with men in pleated skirts?
Yes. Every man goes through that, right? Okay.
Sure.
All right. So back in the 90s, I guess, so I'll date myself. I'm mid-50s now. But I was going to graduate school in the 90s.
Gen X forever.
Yes. Very, very Gen X. I was going to graduate school in the 90s, get an MFA in creative writing, very much in like the artsy scene. I think the culture of fashion kind of draws on that, that the vibe in music then, and at least the music I was listening to and the people I was hanging out with, was very like anti-corporate, very much don't sell out, you know, stay authentic. And in that context, with everyone I knew, was to just look poor, just jeans and t-shirts. So, you know, thrifting in that light was not to find something really interesting or vintage. It was just like, I want to look like these clothes. The signal is like, I'm not corporate. I'm not, you know, aspiring to the upper classes. I am very much like ground level. Grunge rock was big then, you know, all that. So I was happy to be there because it's cheap and easy, you know, and comfortable. And so it was actually suited me just fine. But then over time and working and having some money and needing to get clothes to go to conferences and out to nice restaurants and everything, I didn't know what to do. Probably like our callers, you know, you look around, you're like, well, I need to buy something nice, but what? Because I'm really uncomfortable buying fancy clothes or anything. And I tried one of my dad's hand-me-down Zena suits, and I looked a little like an Italian mobster, so I passed on that look for conferences. And
I feel like every man's tried the Zena and been like,
yeah,
nope.
Nope. Yeah, I'm only in my 30s, you know, come on.
Maybe if I were 30 years old.
Yeah, a few things happened. One, I feel like the culture changed a little bit, started to shift away from that anti-sellout thing, and it became a little less important to be that way. And one of the things that really made the big difference for me was the arrival of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. And it was very much called, it originally was called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. So I was the absolute target market. It has a broader theme these days, but it was very much for me. I happened to be living in San Francisco at the time, so near the Castro. So I was living very much in, there was a lot of queer men around
in
me.
In the queer eye?
Yes, I was in the eye of the queer storm.
Eye of the queer.
And so I found it fun. I found it actually totally thrilling. And I learned a few things. I picked up a couple brands. The one that made the most difference, the first thing I bought was a John Varvatos jacket, like a sport coat to go to a conference. And Varvatos was the perfect thing because he is the bridge between like sort of making fashion cool for people that come from the indie rocker punk world. Like that's
absolutely
kind of his
He's
whole,
like got a rock and roll soul.
Yeah. And I just one of the men they dressed on Queer Eye, they put him in a denim Barbados jacket. And I was like, huh. And then from there, it turns out some of my friends were doing the same thing. And a friend of mine, you know, here, when I visited him here, we went to New York. And he's like, you got to go to this place, Barney's. This is what we're doing. So we literally, instead of doing the things you normally do in New York at the time, just finding grungy little clubs and going out, drinking and eating all night. We went to Barney's.
You went to Barney's.
We went to Barney's.
Did you go to the
I feel like Barbados is a gateway drug. Yes. I need to add Barbados to my list.
Yes.
I love 100%. That transition from Queer Eye, Barbados, Barney's.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And I walked through Barney's and it was like, it just worked. The curtains parted and I was like, oh my God, these clothes are amazing. And like I didn't feel upset to be there. I didn't feel like I was selling out. It just felt amazing. Oh, one of the best first things I ever bought was this incredible Etro wool jacket that cost. It was like a crazy splurge, but it was so beautiful. And like you say, that's where I recognized in literally taking it off the rack and holding it, putting it on of like, oh my God, you get what you pay for. You know, this is the quality, just like the density of it, the beautiful silk on the inside. The Etro colors are always amazing.
Do you still have it, Scott?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I might be buried in that jacket. It's just fantastic. So it was just a lot of fun. I loved it. I didn't like start reading magazines or totally getting into the fashion scene, but I absolutely developed a real appreciation for it. And it got into women's fashion too and started buying my wife tons of clothes, which she is super appreciative for. And she gets, every time we go to New York, she gets comments on the street like, oh, I love your jacket. And she's like, yeah, my husband bought that.
Wait, Scott, your wife trusts you to buy her clothes.
Oh, yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. I'd say a significant majority of her like nice clothes is the ones I bought her. So I'm into it. You know, I was kind of into art history and stuff in college too. And like, I just have an appreciation for fashion as art too. And so I love looking at a Tom Brown show or, you know, Balenciaga or Valentino. Like those, even though most people, and certainly me as a youth, you'd look at a runway show, you'd just shake your head like, what is this? Just nonsense for the rich, you know, just ridiculousness. And now I totally get it and love it and am challenged by it. I wouldn't say every time I see a runway show, I immediately get it and I understand what the, you know, it is, but it's like good art, you know, it challenges you and makes you step back and like, do I like this? Why do I like this? Why do I feel this way?
How far, Scott, have you gone in your own fashion journey? I mean, do you wear Tom Brown?
I love the skirt, but I don't think I'd actually wear it. Or would I?
If you go to a fashion week with Christina, would you promise right now on the show to wear the
Tom
Brown
actually,
skirt?
Yes, actually, 100%. If I could go to a fashion week with Christina, I will.
First.
Yes. I'll get the Tom Brown skirt. Yes.
Yes.
Scott, have you noticed a difference between the way you wear your clothing versus your wife? Like, do you, any difference between how long you keep items, how often either of you will feel like you have a shopping need?
I actually buy more clothes than she does because I like buying them. I have more clothing regrets than she does, because I'll just buy stuff because it looks cool and it's like it's on sale. I'm like, oh my God, I got to have that. And then I get it and I'm like, oh no. I will say, you know, it was interesting when you were just going down that list of brands and talking about their sustainability. My fashion journey did not include sustainability, even though along the way, I was running Green Tech Media and devoting my entire life to climate change and clean energy and everything. When it came to fashion, I just put it in another box and didn't even think of it as like where I would make a difference on sustainability. And it's actually very recently. And I don't even know if I'm that good at it now. Like, I still think of clothes as like the exception. Like, if I want to buy something, I actually don't look too hard. For example, like when Zara came around to the US, I was initially kind of, I didn't even know it was fast fashion. I thought it was just a European, like a Spanish cool clothing place that came to the US. So I went there and it was like, oh my God, it's cheap too. This is amazing. And I had no concept of the notion of fast fashion or that like by shopping at Zara, I was a part of that cycle at all. I was just like, oh, this is great. It's like European style clothing.
No one did at that time.
Yeah.
And frankly, their stuff back in those days was so much better made than what we consider fast fashion now. It was like a whole other level. I mean, of clothes. You can
still. It was so well made. Yeah.
The problem with it in those days really was more that they were knocking off actual designers.
Yes, it did look familiar. And I guess that was kind of the good thing. It's like, oh, I could afford this. It's amazing.
Scott, so I wanted to ask you, because you brought something up before the show about Century 21, which I'd heard from other men, that when it closed, it was a big loss. And when it closed, I got text messages from men saying, where do I shop now that they closed? And I just thought it was like a cheesy outlet. I think I'd been once many, many years ago, but it turns out it had amazing gems at great prices.
Incredible. Yes. So it was at the World Trade Center area. The friend who brought me to Barney's, that was his other New York secret. Like, okay, we're going to, you know, let's go to Barney's, but then we'll go to Century 21 where you can actually afford to buy the things that you just saw at Barney's. And again, like versus going vintage or thrift shopping, it was really exciting to get stuff new that was cheap. So, and it was hit or miss. But, you know, the place was incredible. If you were kind of excited about brands, they at least had a little section of Fendi and Valentino. And, you know, you just go down the line and or like a Paul Smith little corner and you'd go through and you're like, oh, my God, there's like three things that fit, you know, like for like a third of the price. It was amazing. And there, I guess if I bought something that I regretted, I at least could say, well, I got it for 70% off. So that's OK. I did get a lot of stuff from Gilt because Gilt has Varvatos and Theory and Vince, some of the like the good like men's clothes and Paul Smith. And you just sort of watch the sales and then they ship it to you and you can send it back. So it made it really easy. It's much less fun because you're not literally in person looking at it and able to kind of see how it feels and maybe try it on. But it gives you that, I mean, I guess that's the dark side of all this. It gives you the e-commerce sort of rush of like, oh my God, there's so many things and this sale's going to end in 3 hours. And, oh, you know, and if I'm a member, I get a first look at it and all this kind of nonsense that you get pulled into. But it did the trick.
That is probably, by the way, for those who aren't familiar, Gilt is G-I-L-T, not G-U-I-L-T. It's like gold covered Gilt,
right?
That kind of thing.
Even though I have some guilt about my purchases there still.
Guilt about guilt. Well, that, thank you, Scott. And you are even more, I don't know, you're bordering on a fashionista. We may have to.
No, I am so appreciative of you guys getting me back into this because I have a Vogue membership. I read fashion magazines all weekend now and I love it. I love it.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
cool.
There was another voicemail. So if you have a minute, let me just read this. This guy was so into it. He left three voicemails because he had so much to ask. So let me just quickly summarize. It was Steve. He's a 40-something dad from the suburbs. He had a few questions. A good methodology to follow to research if you're researching a brand to figure out if they're really walking the walk, not just as we found with H&M doing some conscious choice labeling, but it was fudging the numbers. So he had that question, but then he called back And he asked, what's the best way to take care of your clothes for longevity? Because he buys like seventh generation or sort of eco brand laundry detergent, but he finds it's crap laundry detergent. So he's sort of torn up about how do I do the best job taking care of these clothes? And then he called back again and he asked if wool is okay, because he tries to live in a zero impact on animals. So is it an animal product that he should feel bad about, or is there anything he's missing there? So he has a lot of questions.
We love you, Steve.
Steve, you are wonderful. God bless you.
Yes, call with more questions.
All right, so
I love it.
What do you think?
I did some reading about wool, and it's horrifying. The whole industry is horrifying. There are certifications you can look for, but none of them protect the animals against basically having their hind quarters chopped off without anesthesia and their tails chopped off without any numbing. I guess it protects them from getting bitten by flies and things like that. There's a word for it's like muciling or something like that, but there's a procedure that they do on sheep to take off the wool off their butt, basically, so the flies don't get to them, but they don't use numbing agent often, and they also take off their tails and don't use numbing agent. There's all sorts of terrible things that happen to sheep, that especially sheep that are in flocks of like 2,700 or more, which is the typical sort of size a large scale sheep farm. But according to this site, they don't protect, it's not entirely, it's like most cases and probably not regulated.
Okay, so it's another factory farming kind of situation.
It's a factory farming situation, right. And it's a systemic issue, and it's like one that customers can't, it just goes back to my point, like you can't become a scientist and a regulator and a farm auditor. Brands should be more focused on their supply chains, as should regulatory bodies. So buy less, buy better. And then eco-good detergent, I would just say there's lots of options out there. I didn't know seventh generation was not sufficient. I've tried Blue Land. I like that brand a lot, and they work well. They come in little tablets, so you're not basically buying water.
Steve, if you're having trouble getting stains out of clothes because of your detergent, try soaking them overnight before you wash them, and it tends to let stains sort of release, or use smaller stain removers and things like that. I mean, that if you want to do it well, it's not just going to be dumping everything in a laundry machine and expecting the laundry machine to do it for you. There really is effort involved in removing stains and things like that, especially collar stains in the back of men's collars and things like that. They require work. By the way, thank you, Steve. Thank you, David, for your questions. Keep them coming. I do want to say, by the way, that there's something really we love getting people's DMs. I love getting the emails. But there's something lovely about hearing a voice on a line asking these questions. You hear the human in there. So keep them coming. Please don't be afraid to call a telephone, which my 23-year-old son, by the way, says that nobody will phone us who's under 30. So we challenge you under 30s out there to phone us. That is all for the show. Please support us by following us on Twitter at Hot Buttons Pod, and now on Instagram at hotbuttons.pod, or send a link to friends or colleagues, and go to Apple or Spotify and give us a rating. I know that's a pain, but it really helps us. We're also streaming on Amazon Music. We really appreciate your support. If you want to email us with story ideas, send a note to hotbuttons@postscriptaudio.com, or please leave us a voicemail at our new call-in line. It's at 508-622-5361. So give us a call. Hot Buttons is hosted by me, Christina Binkley, Sheila Kim Parker, and Rachel Kibbe. The show is produced by Postscript Media. Our senior editor is Ann Bailey. Our engineers are Greg Villefranc and Sean Marquand. Cecily Miza Martinez is our managing producer. Stephen Lacey, Scott Clavenna, and Rachel Kibbe are our executive producers. Postscript Media makes podcasts at the intersection of climate with culture, politics, business, and tech. Postscript Media is supported by Prelude Ventures. Prelude is a venture capital firm focused on climate solutions across energy, food, agriculture, transportation, logistics, and advanced materials. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch up with you next week.
And he's like, you got to go to this place, Barney's. This is, you know, this is what we're doing. So we literally, instead of doing the things you normally do in New York at the time, just finding grungy little clubs and going out, you know, drinking and eating all night, we went to Barney's.
You went to Barney's.
We went to Barney's.
Did you go to the food section? Wait, I feel like Barbados is a gateway drug. Yes. I need to add Barbados to my list. Yes. I love 100%. That transition from Queer Eye, Barbados, Barney's. Yeah. Okay. Yes.